You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 4th of March, 2024, on Monocle Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Coming up on today's programme, Haiti declares a state of emergency after a massive jailbreak as the Prime Minister travels to Kenya. Berlin feels the ire of its allies after holding a military meeting on an unsecure system, allowing Russia to hack and leak audio revealing sensitive operational intelligence. And then...
And we think the right solution is to get an independent state in South Yemen, but we want to do it through dialogue, we want to do it through a peace process, so we can check what is good for our people, for the region also.
We hear from a member of Yemen's South Transitional Council. Plus, we'll have a roundup of the latest entertainment news.
I'm Laura Kramer, and I'll be chatting about how a record-breaking Brits Night win could give music labels a much-needed reality check. Plus, Dune's big box office success and the countdown to the Oscars.
All that right here on The Briefing with me, Vincent McAvinney. To Haiti first, where the government declared a 72-hour state of emergency on Sunday after armed gangs stormed a prison in the capital, killing 12 and enabling the escape of around 4,000 inmates. The audacious attack was timed to coincide with a visit to Kenya by the country's Prime Minister Ariel Henry. He's been trying to strike a deal with Nairobi for Kenyan police to deploy to the embattled Caribbean nation to help wrestle back control from violent gangs who control roughly 80% of Port-au-Prince. I'm joined now by Dr. Christopher Sabatini, Senior Fellow for Latin America at Chatham House, and by Navina Couture, multimedia journalist based in Nairobi. Christopher, if I can come to you first, what exactly happened over the weekend in Haiti?
Effectively, the gangs, primarily in Port-au-Prince, which control about 80% of the capital city, formed an alliance under actually a former police officer, but now a gang leader who has the telling nickname of the barbecue, formed an alliance and stormed two prisons and released the prisoners. It's clearly an effort to try to topple this government. The president, Henri, was supposed to step down the 7th this month. And it's while he's outside, the idea was to try to prevent his return and to stage some sort of effectively street coup.
And do we know much about the people who they managed to get out of the prison?
Everyone left pretty much, except for about 100 people. Those who were just too sick or too old to leave. And those who were accused of killing the previous president in 2021, Moise, they remained, but everyone else was out. A lot of them were former gang leaders, kidnappers, murderers, and they've returned to the streets, and they are looting with abandon.
And what is the security and humanitarian situation across the country at the moment?
Security-wise, it's very difficult to get anything outside Port-au-Prince, which has meant that there has been food shortages outside, and largely that's because of gangs seizing those shipments. Even if they were not humanitarian assistance, but simply deliveries for supplies. In that sense, but also that right now, basically the police, the Haitian police, are severely outgunned. Very sadly, yesterday the police unions were texting on Twitter, now X, I guess, that they needed to have the police who were off duty please come in and try to stop the overtaking of the prison. So it's a very tense situation. There's even been rumors, though I can't confirm them, that some of the former prisoners and the gang leaders are encroaching on government property.
And Navina, if I can bring you in, thousands are thought to have died in Haiti over recent years due to gang violence. How do Kenyans feel about their government potentially sending police officers into this situation?
I think there's a lot of skepticism in Kenya, not just among opposition politicians who've basically stopped this deployment for the time being in the courts, but also by the Kenyan public who think that the Kenyan police, you know, that they should focus on what's happening in this country. There's, I think, also a large section of the public who have very little faith in Kenya's police forces based on what they have been doing in the country. They accuse them of being corrupt. They accuse them of extortion. Some human rights groups have also raised the human rights record of the Kenyan police, which is maybe not as bad as in other countries like Uganda and Tanzania, but still there are question marks. And Kenyans are also wondering what exactly the police officers are supposed to do. 1,000 are supposed to go. That's the plan that President Ruto has announced, but it's entirely unclear if they have been trained and even if how they're supposed to communicate.
And I mean, it does seem like the situation is beyond a normal police force, that it's kind of needs a military force to get it under control. Are there concerns for the safety of the officers as well?
Yes, I think that is one of the questions why, and that's one of the reasons why I think the court had called this entire agreement into question, is whether the police is actually the right force to be deployed and to basically tackle this issue. Kenya has volunteered 1,000 police officers. Kenya will also has also asked for $238 million plus equipment in order to be able to pursue this mission. But as you say, it is entirely unclear how, even if all the police officers are going to be deployed from here, what exactly is supposed to happen on the ground. And observers are also warning that it's not just about gang violence, but about the interaction between the gangs, very well connected politicians. And there are a lot of question marks here about what 1,000 police officers can really achieve in Haiti.
And Christopher, it seems very strange that instead of trying to get some kind of broader international force, the Prime Minister of Haiti is focused on trying to get these Kenyan police officers. Why did this come about, and what's been the reaction from others in Haiti?
Sadly, it's basically the only option that's been left. This attempt to bring in Kenyan police forces is really this latest chapter in a sad story. After the transition to democracy in 1986 and then a coup that removed Aristide, there's an attempt to rebuild the country. They dissolve the army. And then with UN support, US support, Canadian, and then also the support of UN Blue Helmets, including Brazilian troops, they tried to rebuild and train the police. They tried to create security. But unfortunately, that didn't work. And the truth is none of these countries now want to step back in. It has failed. It's gotten worse. And so there's simply no appetite for neighbors to go in. And so unfortunately, the U.S. turned to a country that, you know, was stepped up. But it's not an obvious, as Navina was saying, it's not a clear mission, what they're going to be doing. Their role isn't clear. Their equipment isn't clear. It's simply, you know, trying to patch a Band-Aid onto a very severe situation.
And Navina, finally, do we know what the Haitian Prime Minister is up to this week? Because it seems like there's an escalating crisis at home, which could potentially lead to the ousting of his government. Has he got meetings in Kenya with government members there, or is he rushing back now?
Yes, Ariel Henry and President Ruto signed this so-called reciprocal instrument. It's something that the Kenyan court had been calling for in order to be able to move ahead with this mission. They signed it, and when they signed it, he said he was very confident that this was the solution, and he kind of shrugged off suggestions that this might be beyond what a police force can actually achieve. I think at the moment there are issues with airlines landing in Haiti, so I think until that is resolved, it's unclear when he'll be able to travel back.
Christopher and Navina, thank you. That was Christopher Sabatini and Navina Couture. Now here's Monica Lillis with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Vincent. Israel has conducted one of its largest raids in years in the Palestinian administrative capital of Ramallah in the West Bank. At least one person has been killed in the raid that involved dozens of military vehicles entering the seat of Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas's government. Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley has won her first primary contest in Washington, D.C., coming just ahead of the Delegate Rich Super Tuesday contest. Haley still significantly trails Donald Trump, who has won all other states so far in the race for the party's nomination. South Korea says it will begin taking legal action against junior doctors who have refused to end a strike that has severely impacted medical care in the country. Some 9,000 residents and intern doctors walked off the job on the 20th of February over planned increases in medical school admissions. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Vincent.
Thanks, Monica. Now, Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine and rising geopolitical tensions elsewhere have prompted Germany to step up as a military power. But they appear to have made an obvious and highly embarrassing mistake by holding highly sensitive meetings on non-secure platforms. During the call, from which 38 minutes of audio have been leaked by Russian propaganda network RT over the weekend, German military chiefs discuss operations in Ukraine, the possibility of giving Kyiv long-range missiles, and what their targets could be. To make matters worse, they also appear to confirm the presence of British and French military personnel on the ground in the country, something Chancellor Olaf Scholz was reprimanded for publicly hinting at last week. I'm joined now by Dr. Benjamin Tallis, Senior Research Fellow at the German Council on Foreign Relations and co-host of the podcast Berlin Inside Out. Ben, thank you for joining us. Firstly, if we can focus on this call, what exactly went wrong here?
Well, good afternoon from Berlin. Yes, it seems there's been a significant info security breach here. The details are still being contested by various different parts of the German media and German politicians. But one way or another, the Russians, either on their own or via the Chinese, gained access to this really highly confidential call, which then has led to confidential information, as you said, about targeting, about the technical details of the Taurus weapon, and about what allies are doing. It's allowed all that to escape into the public. And so Germany is again damaging its reputation by this leak.
And was this a case of sloppiness, or does this show naivety by Germany?
It's probably a mixture of both. We won't know until the final details are confirmed exactly what the mistake was that allowed this to happen. But it seems to have been both holding the call in such a way, not taking the necessary precautions in order to make sure that this would be secret. But it's also, I think, extremely important to note that actually the discussion was staggeringly basic, given how far ahead we are in the war. It really showed that Germany hasn't done the planning for sending Taurus or for even really considering it as a proper option.
And what's the response been like from international partners? And do you think this might mean that Germany has frozen out of intelligence sharing for a period?
Well, the response has been pretty savage, and rightly so. Ben Wallace has had his second dip in a week at the Germans, the former British defense minister, saying they're neither secure nor reliable as partners. Now, whether they're shut out of intelligence sharing is a matter for people higher up than me to know at this point. But it is important to know that allies such as the UK, for example, have their own intelligence sharing arrangements with certain countries, not all of which will pertain to Germany and or to other EU allies. There are various layers through which countries share their intelligence with their allies. And this is not the first serious info security breach or first intelligence scandal that's hit Germany in the last couple of years, nor even this week, to be honest. So there's a lot of work Germany has to do. And I think this actually relates to the failure to truly step up as a military power, to truly actually own its power in that way, which Germany is trying to address through the so-called Zeitenwende or change of times. But that's really fallen far short of expectations.
I mean, on that point, you know, 2 years now into the war with Ukraine, I mean, they've been roundly and probably rightly mocked for their, sending a few hundred helmets right at the start of the war. But then they did take this new position. They promised hundreds of millions of euros in terms of defence spending, but they still don't seem to really be sort of following through. They don't seem that committed to it. Why is there this reluctance? And obviously, historical reasons, Germany hasn't wanted to build up its military, and nor have other nations around it wanted it to build up its military. But why is this change in mindset not really taking hold?
Well, it's a very interesting question. But just to be clear, Germany did rebuild its military during the Cold War. Germany had an army of 500,000 people, thousands of main battle tanks. It was a frontline state and armed as such. So this myth that Germany never rearmed is just precisely that, a myth. The problem lies after the Cold War. And it's something that actually neighbors and allies have been very keen to tell Germany, we don't mind if you rearm. It was the Polish foreign minister, Radek Sikorski, who said 10 years ago or 12 years ago, speaking at my institution, that he fears German inaction more than German power. And that's the Polish foreign minister speaking. So often these historical reasons are actually used as excuses rather than being real reasons. Now, you mentioned hundreds of millions of euros of defense spending. That's true. There's a 100 billion euro special fund that has been added in addition to Germany's defense budget. But that budget was staggeringly low. And also, it doesn't compensate or go anywhere near to compensating for the approximately 450 billion in missed defense spending over the last 10 to 15 years. So you start to get an idea of the problem then when you put those figures in perspective. Yes, Germany has stepped up a little bit, but it's coming from such a low baseline that that's not making the difference. And the real problem is the mindset. The mindset in the chancellery hasn't changed. And this is why I think Ben Wallace and others have been so critical of Chancellor Olaf Scholz. But it's not just Germany's allies. Within Germany, an MP from the Christian Democrat opposition has called Olaf Scholz a security risk to the whole of Europe. And that's an opinion increasingly shared across the political spectrum in Germany, where people are tearing their hair out at these continued failings.
And I mean, picking up on that point, Olaf Scholz has been roundly criticised for hinting publicly last week that Britain and France had personnel on the ground. I mean, you've mentioned some of the reaction there, but what's the reaction been like in the country of him being somewhat indiscreet and just not getting a grip on this?
I don't necessarily think it's penetrated the wider public discussion, but among experts, it was not seen well. And among politicians who specialize in foreign and security policy, it was really frowned upon very seriously. I mean, to be fair, this was something of an open secret, but having a head of state or a leader and a NATO state leader actually confirm this kind of thing is a different situation. And again, doesn't reflect well on Germany, who and Scholz's position has left Germany increasingly isolated. We saw this on the outskirts of the Paris summit last week, where Scholz was very deliberately isolated by his counterparts and then stood up and made it worse. And this is a real shame because Germany has spent quite a lot of money. It has put money into supporting Ukraine, although you would expect that as Europe's largest economy that is directly affected by the situation in Ukraine and the security threat it creates. But it spent all that money only to do damage to its reputation and its key relationships.
Ben, thank you. That was Dr. Benjamin Tullis. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. Yemen has been in renewed focus over the last few months due to Houthi rebels attacking ships in the Red Sea. But there is also a debate over the future of the country's south. Yemen's Southern Transitional Council seeks an independent state of South Yemen, but through peaceful means. Monocle's Andrew Muller spoke to Amr al-Beed, member of the STC leadership team and lead on the political process and negotiations. Andrew began by asking whether the STC really believes that the United Yemen is no longer workable.
Yeah, I think for sure when it comes to the problem or the question of the unity in Yemen, this needs to be solved. The question of unity and what's the end state? We think as an STC, we think it's not workable anymore to stay united as we were, and we need to find solution for this. And we think the right solution is to get an independent state in South Yemen, but we want to do it through dialogue. We want to do it through a peace process so we can check what is good for our people, for the region also.
I mean, there was a South Yemen for quite a long time until 1990, and then very briefly there was a South Yemen of which your father was president in 1994. What are the practical obstacles now between the situation we have and a reconstituted South Yemen?
After the war in 1994, you know, we got the unity in 1990, and then we had problems with this unity. Mm-hmm. So it ended with a war, and the North occupied the South. Since then, we were struggling to voice our rights, and we think that this unity is not the unity that we want in the South. So the thing is that it got a bit complicated because now in Yemen, the problem is not just about the unity. It's also the problem of the Houthi coup that they done 2014, 2015. So we've got two main problems now. It's how to solve the problem of the coup of the Houthis and how to solve the problem of the unity. So this complication with the region dynamic into this problem made it a bit difficult or nuanced and needs to be navigated through. And that's why it's not like before.
Obviously, there is renewed or increased attention on Yemen due to the Houthis' attacks on Red Sea shipping and the military response to that. Do you see somewhere in that renewed focus on Yemen an opportunity for the STC? Is it easier or harder for you now to make your voice heard?
With this escalation, yes, we got attention from the world. But the thing is that what is the right attention that we need? We got attention, but it's important that we... It's not just about the Red Sea escalation. It needs to be solving the problems in Yemen and not just the escalation in Red Sea. This is something that we condemn. We think that's what the Houthis did is not related to what they claim. It's about Gaza because it has a ramification on our people in the south and in Yemen. But
ramifications in what respect?
Economic.
It makes shipping things in and out of South Yemen harder.
Yes. And you know, the insurance costs get very high and lots of other ramifications, economic ramifications and the situation. So the attention is good, but the thing is that we need this attention to solve the problems, not just to stop one problem.
On the immediate problem, and I know this is happening in the north part of Yemen, not the south part, which you want to represent, but do you think the current campaign of airstrikes against the Houthis will actually work? Will they stop the Houthis from attacking ships if that's what the Houthis are still determined to do?
We think the piecemeal operations is something that it's necessary as a self-defense, but to deter the Houthis, to limit their threats, needs more of a comprehensive approach. We think that this is not enough. Definitely, it's not enough for the Houthis to be deterred. As we can see, been now 2 months doing this.
It hasn't stopped them yet. What would a comprehensive approach look like, as you see it?
It's important that we be coordinated regionally and also locally with internationally recognized government that the STC is also part of. It's important to pressure them economically, pressure them militarily, not just by airstrikes, also on the ground. This is something that needs to be like a diverse pressure to limit their threats in order that they're not going back to do it again. And this needs a full-scale approach, as I said. It's a comprehensive approach.
I mean, would that necessitate, though, involving those regional players which have been at barely one remove participants in Yemen's war, thinking obviously of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, who in some respects have been on the same side in Yemen's war and in other respects on different sides in Yemen's war?
Yeah, for sure. It needs everyone. It needs the region. It needs the two states coming together with the internationally recognized government, which is the STC is also part of. I need to reflect on these coordination all together in order to have one approach together. And this is important, I think.
From where you are now, though, and in terms of, again, going back to the STC's core mission of trying to establish or re-establish an independent South Yemen, what are the next practical steps for you?
For us, as an STC, we joined the government mainly for two reasons. First is to provide services and security to our people. Second thing is to represent this cause within the peace process, under the UN auspices. So that's the only way how we're going to achieve our goals, is to place this problem within the UN and then talk about this and find solutions together. And that's our mission, provide security and services, and also represent this cause.
Where do you see the basis for independence coming from, though? What would be the, I guess, key process? Are you thinking of a referendum or a unilateral declaration of independence?
We have steps for that. Mm-hmm. First is to recognize this, that there is a problem. And then after recognizing it, then we find a framework to solve it, which is to bring and to see what is the problem and then what are the projects. One of the solutions for this problem is to have an independence of South Yemen, or South Arabia, sometimes we call it. Then we have to go back to our people to decide. Do they want this option? Because now we are elites that would decide, or the politicians would think that this is the right solution for them. But then we have to take it back to the people to decide. So referendum, probably one of the mechanisms to solve this problem in the future. So this is one of our options in the future to solve this matter.
And does the STC have a particular idea of what kind of country the new South Yemen would be? Obviously, the previous South Yemen, the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen, which I think was the only out and proud Marxist state in the Middle East, is probably not a model for the 21st century. So what kind of country would a new South Yemen be?
For sure, it won't return as it was before 1990. We think that a very loose model is the appropriate model. It means that a more federal state within the South that can function, more of a state that can be friendly with the region, because at that time, our state wasn't that friendly with our region. And we're looking forward to build a good relationship with our neighbors based on geography. And at the same time, we wanted a more of a very open, loose kind of state.
That was Amma Albeed speaking to Monocle's Andrew Muller. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And finally, on today's show, it's time for an entertainment news roundup with Monocle's Laura Kramer. Laura, firstly, the Brit Awards held in London on Saturday night at the O2 Arena. How did they go down?
Hi, Vincent. I do think that my invitation somehow got missed in the email for this. I don't know how that happened, but it was a really big show, very exciting, especially for Ray. Now, she had a triumphant win at the Brit Awards. She won 6 out of 7 nominations, and she actually won, basically beat out the likes of Adele and Harry Styles for their previous records that they held. And it's a really exciting time, I think, for Ray, because just 3 years ago, she kind of came out and said that her label isn't supporting her and she's got all these albums that she wants to put out in this music. And she's just kind of getting sidelined to do all these other projects and collaborations with other artists. And she became an independent artist then. And so to see somebody like her come back and have this massive success at the Brits is just really exciting. And it makes you wonder what's going to happen for the record labels down the line.
And who else won on the night?
Well, we saw Miss Dua Lipa. She won Best Pop Act. She also performed. Kylie Minogue also received the Global Icon Award. She was also there. And she had actually, you know, it's so great to see Kylie. She's just such a good sport about everything. She is a global icon, obviously. There was a point where one of the hosts, Roman Kemp, wanted to do this Australian type nod where they both took one of Kylie's shoes and drank a drink from it. Now, I don't know if there was actually anything in the shoe or if it was even her actual shoes that she was wearing, but it definitely made headlines.
Yeah, very hard to get the emceeing of those things right. And the reviews weren't particularly great for the job on Saturday, were they? Now, I didn't watch the Brits live. I've caught up with some of it because I was in the cinema watching Dune 2. I'd only recently watched the first one, which is on a couple of streaming platforms at the moment. First one is excellent. The second one is superb. It's gone down pretty well over the weekend, hasn't it?
Oh, it's done massively well, actually a lot better than they expected. So far, it's pulled in 165 million euro at the box office worldwide. It's a super exciting time because people were very excited to see what Denis Villeneuve, the director, was going to bring to the second installment because the first one did so well. Now, the second one, as you well know, Vinny, brought in even more stars from the first installment, and it's not going to stop anytime soon. In fact, many people are thinking that Christopher Nolan, the director of Oppenheimer, was very excited when Dune Part 2 got pushed back because it basically guaranteed that they would be competing in different Oscar cycles for it.
Yeah, I mean, it was already a pretty starry cast in the first one, but you got sort of Florence Pugh coming in on this one and Christopher Walken as well. Some really great performances, but just visually spectacular. And the sound is such an integral part of it. We've got a Monocle on Culture interview at the moment with Hans Zimmer, isn't it? The legendary composer who worked on this film too.
Yes, that's right. And actually, that was the Rob Bound interview that he did for Monocle on Culture. I also spoke to Hans Zimmer about for the first one when I was at the Bond premiere for Bond No Time to Die. And, you know, for the first film, he actually went to the desert to hear the dunes to get the inspiration for it. So this man commits. He's like, if you're getting Hans Zimmer on a soundtrack, you're going to get the best of him. And I think it's actually really exciting to see how well the film is doing, because in part of the reason for that is that it was shot partly in Abu Dhabi in the desert, and they included a lot of the local people there, some 500 local extras, 300 local workers, including on top of the 250 international crew that they brought in. So truly an international effort, and it's exciting to see it doing so well.
Yeah, and it was also, I mean, it was a massive risk by the director, because he took essentially the first book, split it in two, didn't have a guarantee the studio would make the second part. So, you know, it does end the first one on a bit of a cliffhanger, but it seems to have done well. There is one interesting review that's getting a lot of pushback, the Boston Globe's reviewer, who's only given it 1.5 stars, seems to have kind of missed the plot a bit, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think at one point he mentions that it's just not got a lot of color. It's very brown. It is in the desert, I will say. Remember that.
That is the main palette of the desert. The desert's too brown. Yeah, and sort of completely missing the whole thing that, you know, he sort of critiques it for kind of having a white savior narrative, when really, if you watch it, and I think particularly it will come to the play in the second book, which is going to be the third film, it's kind of taking apart the idea of kind of a savior and outside messiah.
And yeah, and I would say also to the point too of what a local production it was, with so many people involved, and it's getting such great international reception as well. And I think, you know, with films like this, you always need to take a hot take. You know, people are going to do that because it's kind of like the Barbenheimer phenomenon. People want to get their review out there, so you're gonna get the far end of the people who are obsessed with it, and the ones who are like, what's the big deal? I don't get it.
Yep. On Sunday, it's the Oscars, the culmination of awards season. Do you think it's pretty much locked in yet? Is Oppenheimer going to sweep the board?
I think it's really hard to see how it couldn't. After the Producer Guild Awards, after the SAG Awards, after everything else that it's won so far, I can't imagine what would take it otherwise. I do think one of the most exciting categories that we're going to see in this Oscars race coming up on Sunday is in the technical categories. A really exciting film, well, harrowing film, but in terms of what it achieved in sound production, was The Zone of Interest. Have you watched it yet?
Yeah, I mean, I went to a cinema to see it because I'd read reviews and just sort of thought that this is one that you kind of have to see in the cinema, not because it's kind of a big spectacular, the likes of Dune, but because the sound is one of the most incredible sound designs I've ever heard. It's like an entire character. It completely haunts you, because for anyone who hasn't seen the film, we should explain, whilst it is set at Auschwitz, you never cross the wall into Auschwitz. You are at the commandant's house and inside that house and in its garden for the whole time, and you only hear the sound of the camp around them. And it is incredible. I know you've done an interview with the sound director on that film, haven't you?
Yeah, and like you said, it's almost like an additional character to it. And you don't see the violence that's happening, but you hear it. It is very eerie. It's just omnipresent, incredible work that he achieved on this. So I do think that the technical awards will be very exciting this time around, but I do suspect that the big ones that we expect, like actor, director, and film, are basically a shoo-in.
And let's see if we get another unpredictable moment, because, you know, the last decade has delivered with the La La Land fiasco and the Will Smith slap and everything else. I think everyone will be watching out for that. Laura Kramer, thank you very much. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. You can find more episodes wherever you get your podcasts. It was produced by Chris Chermak. Our researcher was Neoma Ekwe. And our studio manager was Mariella Bevan. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Vincent McAvinney. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.